Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take complex source material analysis, reports, intel, and boil it down so you get the critical knowledge you need. Today, it's a heavy one, but essential. We're diving deep into the Russian strategic and military picture right now.
And what the sources show is, well, it's a really fascinating, maybe even dangerous paradox.
How so?
Well, on one side, you've got Moscow actively, you know, pushing the limits, launching these hybrid attacks directly at NATO countries.
Okay, testing the waters.
Exactly. But on the other side, simultaneously, the Russian military is deep into this huge systematic effort to adapt, to learn, and recover from the war in Ukraine.
So external aggression and intense internal reform happening at the same time.
Precisely. It's this dual action, this tension, that's really the core of it. We're not just talking about, say, tactical blunders anymore.
Right. We're looking at their bigger strategic planning. Their threat perceptions, which seem to be evolving or at least intensifying.
Yes, and they're planning for a confrontation they seem to view as, well, inevitable and long-term.
So our goal today, for you listening, is to unpack the specific, very detailed ways Russia is doing this, both on the battlefield and behind the scenes in the labs and ministries.
And critically, understanding the anxieties, these deep-rooted fears that are driving these decisions, we need to see the whole system working, not just react to the headlines.
Okay, let's start with those external pressures, though. The sources point to a pretty significant strategic shift recently, one that led to this escalation against Europe. What drove that?
It seems to boil down to their analysis of the political situation in the West, particularly regarding the U.S. They apparently came away with three main conclusions after assessing things post-Anchorage.
Okay, what were they?
Well, first, they seemed to conclude the U.S. wouldn't just hand them a victory by forcing Ukraine into a bad deal. No easy out there.
Right, so no guaranteed win via diplomacy.
Second, they felt the U.S. leadership, maybe transactional, was still open to having some kind of relationship with Moscow, even with the war dragging on.
Interesting. So a door still open, perhaps?
Maybe. But the third realization is the kicker. They assess that the U.S., while wanting to contain Russia, doesn't see Ukraine's immediate fate as its absolute top priority. Intervention, real, decisive intervention, would only be a last resort.
And that assessment gave them what? Freedom to act.
It gave them, as one source put it, ample room for creativity, essentially permission in their minds to shift tactics.
Which led them to target Europe directly.
Yes. The objective changed. Now, Russia seems to be aiming for a kind of hybrid military propaganda defeat of the collective West, primarily Europe and NATO.
A hybrid defeat. What does that mean in practice?
It means trying to knock Europe out of the game, psychologically and politically, to disrupt things enough that public pressure forces European governments to stop supporting Ukraine.
That's a huge shift. The target isn't just Ukraine's military anymore, it's the stability of Europe itself.
Exactly. And we've seen the evidence pile up. Analysts are saying Russia clearly crossed a Rubicon with these recent actions, even while trying hard to maintain plausible deniability.
Plausible deniability seems key here. What specific incidents are we talking about?
Well, look at the pattern just recently. You had that squadron of Russian drones over Poland, September 9th, spotted, partially intercepted.
Okay.
Then more drone flights soon after, violating airspace in Romania, Germany, Norway, Denmark. Add to that planes deliberately buzzing Estonian airspace.
And the cyber domain too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Major sustained cyber attacks causing real disruption. Think about the Berlin airport systems being messed with for a significant time. That's not random noise.
And the motivation seems pretty clear. They've already hit Ukraine hard, right? Power plants bombed since late 22. No civil aviation left to target there.
Exactly. They've kind of run out of escalatory steps within Ukraine that don't involve, you know, unthinkable weapons, so Europe becomes the target for psychological pressure.
Show Europeans that supporting Kyiv means chaos at home. Turn public opinion against their own leaders.
That seems to be the goal. Make life inconvenient, maybe even scary. And the sources suggest if disrupting airports doesn't send the message strongly enough.
Energy facilities are next.
That's identified as the next logical high-impact target. Easy to hit, causes immediate pain. But the fascinating part is how this is an explicit test of NATO.
Testing Article 5.
Testing the hypothesis that Article 5 is, in Moscow's view, maybe just for show. Especially, and this is their cynical view, for, quote, second-class allies, they want to see if NATO actually blinks.
These attacks are cautious, though. Hesitant, deniable, often inconclusive.
Precisely. They cause disruptions, sow doubt, force NATO into awkward discussions. but they're calibrated just below the threshold that would automatically trigger a collective military response. It's probing.
And NATO is reacting. We saw that European Security Summit in Copenhagen discussing Sweden's idea about drone defense.
Right, devolving responsibility to the national level for intercepting drones. It's a practical step. It raises NATO's pain threshold, so every drone doesn't become an Article 5 crisis.
Makes sense tactically.
It does, but the big warning here, the really chilling part from the sources, is that by doing this, by systematically testing NATO, Russia is genuinely risking stumbling into a wider war.
Like an accidental escalation.
Like creating their own Franz Ferdinand moment. An incident that spins out of control because they miscalculated. They're basically repeating their 2022 mistake, assuming NATO will be weak, divided, indecisive, just like they wrongly assumed Ukraine would collapse.
That's a sobering thought.
Yeah.
Miscalculating the adversary's will, potentially twice.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the external picture, probing, testing, high-risk behavior. But you said there's a simultaneous internal story. What's happening inside the Russian military system?
Yeah, this is crucial. While they're doing this testing externally, internally, they've moved way beyond the idea that the military was just, you know, rotten or incapable of learning. That narrative misses a huge effort.
What kind of effort?
Moscow has quietly, but very deliberately, built a complex ecosystem for learning from the war. It started informally, sure, soldiers sharing tips, welding on extra armor ad hoc.
The kind of bottom-up stuff we saw early on.
Right. But by early 2023, this became institutionalized, a systematic top-down process driven by the general staff.
Institutionalized learning. It sounds almost like they've created a dedicated war lessons industry complex. How does that actually work? How does info get from the trenches to, say, a defense manufacturer?
It's highly structured. They sent dedicated teams, staff officers, researchers, right to frontline command posts starting back in 2022.
What was their job?
To observe operations directly, interview soldiers and commanders, go through the logs, collect raw data on what worked, and maybe more importantly, what didn't.
And where did those reports go? Just filed away?
No, that's the key. They were disseminated widely. Up to Rostov HQ, back to the general staff in Moscow, over to the military academies, and critically, directly to the defense firms.
That link to the defense industry must have been vital, especially given the horror stories about equipment failures early on.
Massive failures. Sources mention, for example, a snap inspection finding defects in like 30% of electronic warfare systems. Just imagine. And worse, analysts estimated something like 60 to 70% of EW failures between 2022 and 2024 were down to just poor quality electronic components. Basic stuff failing.
So how did they fix that or try to?
They moved fast. The Ministry of Defense reportedly relaxed some R&D rules to speed things up. They sent industry specialists into occupied Ukraine right near the front, just like they did in Syria, to see the problems firsthand.
Closing the gap between the designers and the users.
Exactly. And they pulled in civilian universities and even defense tech startups to get fresh ideas and bypass some of the old bureaucracy.
And did that yield results? New capabilities.
Absolutely. You see it directly in things like the increased production of modified Shahed drones. They adapted them based on battlefield use. Glide bombs got better, more precise.
And that drone unit, Rubicon.
Yes, Rubicon. Think of it as an elite dedicated drone R&D and operations hub. Its whole purpose is to experiment with UAV tactics, standardize them, and push innovation quickly. It's their central drone brain trust, basically.
Okay. So hardware improvements, definitely.
Right.
What about doctrine? Training, the human side.
Also, major changes. The sources mention over 450 interim modifications to combat manuals in just 3 years. That's constant updating.
450. What kind of changes are we talking about?
Some are very practical, very granular, making simulators more realistic based on actual combat footage, changing tactical first aid procedures because of the types of injuries they were seeing.
Things learned the hard way.
Very much so. Even teaching specific new skills, like how do you drive a BTR or a tank when you know there's a drone watching you, trying to target you? That's a new reality.
But you mentioned a cultural shift, too, with junior officers.
Yes. And this could be huge if it sticks.
Right.
Junior officers are getting 2 extra months of supplemental training now. And the really important part, they're being taught something called mission planning.
Mission planning. That sounds almost Western.
It does, doesn't it? It's a big deal because it pushes back against the traditional, incredibly rigid, top-down Russian command style. Instead of just being told, go take that hill, follow these exact steps, they're supposedly being taught to understand the objective and then figure out how to achieve it more autonomously. using their own initiative.
Giving junior leaders more flexibility, that could really change things on the ground.
It could. It's an attempt to inject adaptability into a system that's historically been very brittle, very slow to react at lower levels.
Why? There's always a but, isn't there? The sources must also point out limits to this learning, right?
Yeah.
Implementation problems.
Oh, absolutely. The gap between the PowerPoint briefs in Moscow and the muddy reality at the front is still huge. For instance, a major overhaul of the quality control system for manufacturing was recommended. Hasn't happened.
So good ideas aren't always put into practice.
Right. And discipline remains a massive issue. Commander quality is wildly variable. Units still fail to coordinate effectively with each other. Basic stuff, but it persists.
And there was that disturbing detail about health issues.
Yes. Tragically, the sources note a real surge in frontline soldiers contracting HIV. Apparently due to things like reused syringes in field hospitals, just generally poor sanitation. It's a grim indicator of how strained the logistics and medical systems are, despite the high-level reform efforts.
It shows that disconnect between the institutional strategy and the harsh tactical reality.
Precisely. And that tactical reality, especially with drones everywhere, dictates the fighting style. Commanders know they can't just charge forward with tanks like in the old days.
Drone surveillance makes massed armor assaults suicidal.
Completely suicidal. So the adaptation is forced. Rely on small infantry assault teams, often poorly trained reserves, to probe and try to break through defenses.
Which leads to
extremely high casualties. It's attritional, grinding warfare. That's the operational price they seem willing to pay, while this longer-term institutional adaptation and reform process grinds on.
Okay, so this internal transformation, learning, adaptation,
yeah,
it directly feeds into our final area, Russia's threat perceptions. Have those fundamentally changed?
The sources suggest the framework hasn't really changed, but the war has definitely amplified and reinforced their existing anxieties, especially because the war starkly revealed their conventional inferiority compared to NATO.
And that perceived weakness makes them focus even more intensely on perceived threats from the U.S.
Exactly. Two long-standing U.S. programs or concepts really dominate their strategic planning. They frame it under this idea of a potential massive aerospace attack.
Okay, what's the first one?
Prompt Global Strike, or PGS. This has haunted them for years.
What's the fear there?
It's the fear that the U.S. could theoretically hit any target on Earth with precision conventional weapons in about an hour. The nightmare scenario for Moscow is a decapitation strike.
Taking out their leadership and nuclear command.
Precisely. Neutralizing Russia's strategic deterrent forces before they could even be used. A conventional first strike that disarms them. It's a core fear driving their modernization.
And the second big fixation?
Ballistic missile defense, BMD. Especially U.S. concepts like the multi-layered Golden Dome architecture.
Do they think it will actually work?
Russian analysts are often skeptical about the technical feasibility. But they fear the intent behind it. They see BMD, particularly any space-based components, as fundamentally destabilizing.
How so?
They view it as an attempt to negate their retaliatory nuclear capability, upsetting the whole offensive-defensive balance that underpinned Cold War stability. It forces them into costly countermeasures just to ensure their deterrent remains credible.
So those are long-standing anxieties.
Yep.
How has the war in Ukraine added new layers to this?
Several big ones. First, obviously, NATO expansion. Finland and Sweden joining wasn't just symbolic. It materially changed the military balance, especially in the north.
The Baltic Sea as a NATO lake.
That's exactly how they see it now. It creates huge new planning challenges for them around St. Petersburg, Kaliningrad. And they specifically worry about things like U.S. HIMARS or ATAC CMS potentially being based in Finland, putting critical sites in northern Russia at risk.
So geography matters. What else?
How they view Ukraine itself. It's shifted from just being a conflict zone to being seen as a permanent forward base for the West.
Launch pad.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
All the Western military aid, the advanced weapons like long-range missiles, F-16s, they don't see this as just helping Ukraine defend itself. They interpret it as part of a long-term strategy to weaken Russia and a sign the West is willing to risk direct confrontation.
And Ukraine hitting targets inside Russia reinforces this.
Absolutely. They see Ukraine's growing capability for cross-border strikes as proof that it's become a platform for potential future Western attacks directly against Russia.
Okay. And you mentioned a new domain anxiety earlier, space.
Yes. The war in Ukraine really brought this home for them. The role of Western commercial space companies, Starlink for communications, Maxar, BlackSky for satellite imagery.
Providing near real-time intelligence to Ukraine.
Exactly. Supporting Ukraine's C4ISRT command control, communications, computers, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and targeting. It confirmed Russia's long-held fears about the military utility of space, even commercial space.
Continuous surveillance, enabling rapid strikes.
That's the capability they see. So now their military thinkers are pushing hard to formally recognize space as a full-fledged warfighting domain. They want more dual-use satellites, and crucially, they're focused on developing anti-satellite capabilities.
Like what? Lasers? Missiles?
They specifically mention things like the Peresvet laser system, potentially blinding satellites, or even using hypersonic weapons to physically destroy sensors in orbit. They want the ability to deny that space advantage to an adversary.
Finally, what about nuclear anxieties? Are those heightened too?
Definitely. There's concern about what they see as an erosion of the nuclear taboo, NATO members openly discussing tactical nuclear weapon readiness, for instance.
And the end of arms control treaties.
That's a big one. The expiration of New START in 2026 looms large. They worry about what happens after. Their planning has to account for worst-case scenarios.
Such as?
Such as the U.S. freed from treaty limits, potentially rapidly increasing its deployed nuclear forces, ICBMs, SLBMs, bombers. They calculate potential numbers, like the U.S. technically being able to deploy over 7,000 warheads or rearming B-1 bombers with nuclear capability.
So they have to plan against a potential unconstrained American buildup.
Yes. And that perceived threat reinforces their own commitment to maintaining and modernizing their strategic nuclear forces. It becomes non-negotiable for them.
Okay, let's try and pull these threads together. What we're seeing is a Russia engaged on two fronts simultaneously.
That's right. Externally, you have this kinetic and hybrid testing probing NATO trying to break European unity over Ukraine. Internally, you have this deep, sustained institutional effort to learn, adapt, and transform the military for a long confrontation.
A confrontation they believe is inevitable.
Driven by those deep-rooted anxieties, PGS, BMD, now amplified by the experience in Ukraine, by NATO expansion, by the West's support for Kyiv, and by the demonstrated power of space assets. It all confirms their narrative of facing an encroaching, technologically superior West.
So the internal transformation isn't just about fixing the stakes from 2022. It's about building the military they think they'll need for the 2030s and beyond.
Exactly. It's a decade-long project, maybe longer. Reconstituting, reforming, preparing for what they see coming.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener. Given this relentless focus on institutional learning in Russia, and their experts are already writing about future war involving AI decision-making, drone swarms, combat robots by the early 2030s.
The next generation of conflict.
What specific systematic countermeasures do NATO and Western partners need to accelerate today, right now, to make sure they don't fall behind Russia's emerging institutionalized vision for 21st century warfare?
Something to think about.